Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
This show is part of the Grand Embassy Productions.
In this perias opeli upro da upro bindeba Dharma valiana teli sudomo sacera de tendeba
Gamarjoba, and welcome to the history of Sacagawea, Georgia. I'm your host, Roberto, and this is episode 46, The Siege of Phasis/Boti. In today's episode, we'll cover the events surrounding Nacho-Ragan Siege of Boti. This show could not run without our wonderful Patreon members, who consistently support us month to month to make sure that we can keep the podcast going. Thank you to John Aaron, Vivek Dandekar, Daniel Bowline, Grace E.D., Konstantine Megrelishvili, David Montgomery, Quinn Campagna, Emily Bavona, Hal the Legionnaire, Hallie Kuntz, Eric Nicholson, Mitchell Dutt, and Andrew Schneider. You are all amazing, and thank you for everything that you do to support the show. Also, in a few episodes' time, we will be doing an AMA for episode 50. Feel free to send in questions about anything you'd like to know about me, the show, anything that you're interested in, and send it to thehistoryofsacagawea.georgia@gmail.com with the subject being AMA. You can also DM me in all socials that we are on asking questions. Just put AMA in the beginning of the message. Or you can become a Patreon member at the $5 or up tier, join our Discord, and ask it there and chat with other listeners. Now, on to today's episode. The defeat of the Dilamite contingent by the Sabir forces sent Nacho-Ragan into rage. He thought that he had had the Sabir force in his grasp, but the Romans gained the upper hand. He made camp close to the Roman fort of Nessos and invited the Roman commander, a man named Martin, to parley. Martin agreed, and they met in the Persian camp. Nacho-Ragan looked Martin up and down, and according to Agathias, he said,
"You are such a shrewd and able general and person of great influence among the Romans. And yet far from showing any inclination to stop the two monarchs from engaging in a mutually exhausting conflict, you have allowed them to persist in the protracted ruination of their respective states. If, therefore, you are agreeable to the idea of a negotiated settlement, why not move with your army to the Pontic city of Trebizond, whilst we Persians shall remain here? In this way, we shall discuss the terms of the armistice at our leisure, using trusted messengers to convey our views. If you do not voluntarily withdraw your army from here, you may rest assured that you will be driven out by force, for I hold victory in the palm of my hand. And mark you, I wear her no less securely than I wear this.
Nachoragan then showed his ring. Martin eyed the ring and replied,
I do indeed consider peace to be the fitting object of our prayers, and a most precious possession, and shall help you in your efforts to reinstate her. However, I think it would be better if you were to move with all speed to Iberia while I went to Mochericus. That would enable us to examine the immediate situation. As for victory, you may indulge in boastful talk if you wish, and presumptuously imagine that she is up for sale and is there for the taking. But I say that the scales of victory are weighted according to the discretion of divine providence, and they do not incline towards the boastful and the arrogant, but towards those to whom the architect of the universe nods his approval.
With that, Martin returned to his camp in Nessos. Nachoragan was infuriated by the Roman commander's belittlement, but his mood changed when a scout arrived with good news. They discovered that the fortress in the town of Pulti was made entirely of wood, and that it was surrounded by plains that were suitable to camp in. Armed with this new information, Nachoragan moved camps to lure the Romans to a location he could better control. It also helped that Pulti lied right on the Black Sea, and west of the Roman fort of Nessos. The Romans would be forced to retain control of the area immediately, lest the Persians get access to the Black Sea. Under the cover of darkness, Nachoragan lowered pontoons and wagons into the Rioni River and moved his supplies and men across it undetected. Part of Nachoragan's plan was to take the river to Pulti and reach its south side. After bypassing Nessos from a distance, he made his way down to Pulti. The next morning, Roman scouts reported that the Persian camp was abandoned. Martin ordered his men to make their way towards Pulti, but Nachoragan was already halfway there. In a desperate effort to slow the Roman pursuers, Nachoragan ordered a barrier be constructed of timber, smaller boats, and even live elephants. This improvised tactic worked surprisingly well. The Persians captured two ships after their crews abandoned their vessels to swim for their comrades rather than be dashed against the barrier. Martin finally arrived at Pulti after marching overland. The commander of the fort had already begun fortifications. In total, the Romans employed 5 commanders to defend the city. Martin would assist Justin, son of Germanus, at the highest point facing the sea. The middle section was held by Angylus, whose troops were reinforced by Berber soldiers armed with shields and lances. Finally, there was Theodorus, who commanded Zanian heavy infantry, and Philomathius and his Isaurian slingers and dart throwers. A massive rampart was built in front to withstand Nachoragan's first assault on Pulti and reinforce the walls as they had degraded with age in many places. The Romans scrambled to make repairs on the walls where they could. Then they dug a moat lined with stakes and filled it with water to ensure the stakes remained hidden. Merchant boats were raised above the walls of the city to further shield it from Persian arrows. Soldiers armed with bows, slings, and even catapults were stationed in these boats. The commander Valerian took charge of a similar arrangement on the opposite side. All of this was to prevent a close-quarter siege, since the Romans would now have the high ground. The Romans still faced a problem of protecting the remaining ships along the Rioni River. To address this, Dabrazegas the Ant and Elminegir the Hun sailed upriver as far as possible. To their delight, they found that the captured ships had become unmoored by the swift Rioni River and recaptured them, supplies and all. Meanwhile, Nachoragan continued his march towards Pulti. He planned to test the Roman defenses through a series of light skirmishes and see if he could draw them into a battle outside the fort, which he knew he'd win. As they approached, the Persians released volley after volley of arrows against the Romans. Although the defenses worked well, they faced many casualties. Angylus and Philomathius disregarded Martin's order to hold their defensive positions, and rushed out the gate to meet the enemy in open battle. Theodorus's pleas to stick to the plan fell on deaf ears, forcing him to join. The Dillum knights held their ground and waited for the Romans to approach, then encircled them. With no hope of escape, the Romans turned outwards and charged. The fury in their enemies' eyes frightened the Dillum knights, allowing the Romans to break through and retreat back to the fort. Now let's return to the Persian side. The moats that the Romans had spent time digging, well, the Persians simply filled them with dirt. But this took much longer than Nachodagan had expected, so the Persians returned to camp. The following morning, a messenger that had clearly traveled a long way appeared before the Roman troops. He pulled out a letter and announced he was sent from Constantinople by the Emperor Justinian himself. Overjoyed, Martin read the message aloud to his troops.
"We have sent you a second army no smaller than the one you already have. Yet even if the enemy should happen to be numerically much stronger than you, their superior numbers will never do more than match your superior courage, so that the apparent disparity will cancel itself out. But to prevent them from boasting even of a superiority on paper, receive this army too, and note that it has been sent not in response to any real or pressing need, but merely to produce a dazzling and impressive display. Be of good cheer, therefore, and acquit yourself with energy and enthusiasm, bearing in mind that we shall play our part to the full."
Martin then asked when he could expect them, to which the messenger said they were less than a day's march away. This infuriated him, and he told the messenger,
"Let them turn back and go home as fast as they can. I will not have them here on any occasion. It would be intolerable if, when these men here, having for so long shared with me the hardship of so many battles, are already on the verge of destroying the enemy and achieving total victory, those others should come along at the 11th hour, when their presence is no longer needed, and after having shared scarcely any of the hazards, receive an equal share in the glory and have their names linked with the triumphant finish of the campaign. And the greatest injustice of all is that they would reap the same material benefits as all these here present. Let them stay where they are for just as long as it takes them to pack up and get started on the return journey. These men here will more than suffice for the task of bringing the last stage of the war to a successful conclusion."
Martin turned to his troops and asked,
"May I assume that these are your sentiments too?"
His troops voiced their approval. Seeing his men so encouraged, Martin couldn't help but smile. For you see, the imperial messenger was in fact an imposter he had planted to raise morale. In addition, this misinformation reached the Persian camp, spreading confusion and alarm. They had marched for days, held the siege, and now they were going to have to fight from both sides. Nachodagan dispatched part of his army to deal with the non-existent reinforcements, including a large part of his cavalry. He was so sure that he'd be able to burn Polti to the ground that he ordered his porters to drop their tools and join in if they saw smoke rising in the distance.
Hello, we're Orsa and Chris from the podcast of Flatpak History of Sweden, now with our brand new podcast called Kingdom.
We're ranking all the Swedish kings, queens, and regents in a number of categories to see how interesting or great they are. We'll look at how successful they were in battle, if they moved the country forward or not, and of course, if they got up to any crazy or raunchy madness during their reign.
In the end, we'll decide if they're interesting, influential, or maybe just weird enough to be awarded the three crowns. Or, the opposite, they should meet their fate in our meatball grinder. See you there.
Hello, I'm Fry.
And I'm Bree from Pontifex, a papal history podcast ranking all of the popes from Peter to Francis. In each episode, we explore the life of a single pope and contextualize their papacy in world history.
And then we rate them based on the success of their papacy, how scandalous they were, their impact on the secular world, what their face looked like, and more. They may even pick up a new patron sainthood on the way.
In the end, our most impactful papal bull-worthy popes will battle it out for the keys to the pearly gates and to be the popiest pope who ever poped.
You can find Pontifex at pontifex.podbean.com or wherever you find your podcasts. And on the Agora Podcast Network.
In his final days, Alexander the Great's generals asked him who should succeed him. Alexander's answer, the strongest. Taken literally, this would see the close of the classical Greek age, an age thousands of years in the making. Join me, Mark Selleck, as I go back to retell the story of ancient Greece in my series Casting Through Ancient Greece. We will cast our way back to its beginnings, all the way through to the spread of its culture throughout the known world, thanks to Alexander and his generals. You can listen and subscribe to the series at www.castingthroughancientgreece.com, or you can listen on your favourite podcasting platform. Don't forget to follow the series over on Twitter at Casting Greece or on Facebook at Casting Through Ancient Greece. I look forward to seeing you there.
Hello and bonjour. My name is Josh Zucker, and I want to take you on a journey through some of the most exciting events of the late Middle Ages. Valois-Burgundy was one of the medieval world's greatest what-ifs. Its dukes inherited, conquered, and politicked their way into forging a state between the German Empire and the Kingdom of France that rivaled them both. From the Hundred Years' War to the Holy Roman Empire, from urban workers to Joan of Arc, and from gallant knights to gunpowder weapons, the Grand Dukes of the West had a part to play in almost all of Western Europe's biggest developments in the 14th and 15th centuries. If you want to learn more about the glamorous rise and dramatic fall of the Dukes of Burgundy, please join me for Grand Dukes of the West, A History of Valois-Burgundy.
Meanwhile, Justin, son of Germanus, thought it would be a good idea to go to church outside the city walls to pray, taking his men and standards with him. The Persians simultaneously attacked the walls with siege machines. Having taken different routes, neither side was aware of the other. The Persians shot as many arrows over the walls as they could, hoping to take the city by storm. The arrows fell thick and fast, making the air grow dark around them. Beside the archers, soldiers hurled firebrands and hacked the walls with axes under the cover of wicker roofs. Emboldened by Martin's charade, the Romans returned fire with javelins, large stones rolled down the sides, and sling stones that shattered shields and helmets and broke the legs of those that got too close. Defenders in the elevated ships used the high ground to snipe the enemy with bows, killing many. Catapults launched stones and darts cut through their bodies. This spirited defense really showcased the Roman resolve, as they used everything they had to protect Boti. In an effort to disorient the Roman horses, the Persians banged on drums, shouted, and clanged their shields together, creating a thunderous noise. Justin, son of Germanus, heard this cacophony and became incensed. He formed his cavalry, raised the standards, and charged towards the city gates, hoping to take the Persians unawares. The Roman cavalry hurled themselves at the siege units and cut down all in their path with lances, pikes, and swords, dislodging them from the walls and breaking up the siege formation. Terror spread through the Persian troops. Had the Roman reinforcements beaten their cavalry units or invaded the ambush sent for them? Their formation broke, and the Persians retreated. The Dillum Knights spotted the retreating siege units and went to reinforce the retreating Persian allies, only leaving behind just enough of their own force to hold their current position. Angylus and Theodorus believed the Dillum Knights were retreating themselves, reformed once more to regain their honor from their last skirmish, and charged the remaining Dillum Knights. When the other Dillum Knights heard the cry of the charging Romans, they were paralyzed with indecision. Should they go save their comrades, or save the Persians who were already retreating? The Dillum Knights opted to save their kinsmen. However, in their haste, they broke formation and led their kinsmen into a panic, as it looked like they were being attacked from another side. The part of the Persian army closest to them saw the disorder and assumed the Dilim Knights were retreating, and retreated in turn. The Dilim Knights saw them retreating, concluded the Romans were too strong, and actually retreated this time. Both groups were now the cause of the other's retreat, rather than the actual strength of the Roman forces. The Romans stationed behind the walls abandoned the fortifications to reinforce Angylus and Theodorus. By this point, the Persians' left wing had fallen, and the right wing was involved in a rigorous rear guard defense. Despite this disadvantage, the Persians still had one trick up their sleeves: elephants. The imposing animals formed a wall against Roman attacks and threw their ranks into confusion. The height advantage allowed archers to off the Roman force one by one, forcing them into a hasty retreat. Wow, there's quite a lot of retreating in this episode. One of Martin's bodyguards, a man named Ognaris, found himself staring down a charging elephant with no escape. With nowhere to run, he instead raised his spear and struck it right above its brow, driving it as deep as he possibly could. The enraged pachyderm drew back suddenly, seeing the dangling spear in front of its eye, and began thrashing around. It attacked its masters instead of the enemy, tossing some in the air and trampling others to death. It rampaged through the whole Persian army, stomping men and horses alike beneath its powerful limbs. The sounds of battle soon turned to that of panic and lamentation, as everyone fled before the incensed beast. If the elephant did not trample the Persians, the soldiers trampled each other as they desperately fled. The Persians learned the hard way the same lesson King Antigonus II Gornatas of Macedonia and General Hannibal of Carthage learned. War elephants work well until they panic, and they tend to panic easily. The Romans, seeing the Persians' misfortune, formed a shield wall and hurled themselves against their confused enemy. The Persians fled in all directions. Notre-Dagon was utterly confused at this turn of events, as this was a battle he should have won handily. But instead, here he was, retreating from the battlefield. The Romans routed the Persians until Martin recalled them. Defeated, the Persians returned to camp, having lost 10,000 of their 60,000-strong army. The Romans burned the siege equipment, and smoke filled the air. The Persian porters, believing this to be the signal that the city was taken, dropped their tools and headed to Poti to their deaths. Since they were unarmed, the Romans effortlessly killed nearly 2,000 more men. This massive victory bolstered Roman morale even more, as they now knew that they could defeat the Persians even if they were outnumbered. Against all odds, Notre-Dagon snatched defeat from the jaws of victory out of sheer incompetence and bad planning. The Romans returned to Poti as victors and only counted 200 amongst their dead. Persian corpses were stripped of their valuables where they lay. Notre-Dagon, in the meantime, was running low on supplies, and winter was fast approaching. Not wanting the Romans to get the upper hand, he planned to feign an attack. He dispatched a Dilim Knight contingent to attract the Romans' attention to cover his retreat back to Kutaisi and Mojeresis. As soon as he got far enough away, the Dilim Knights broke ranks and withdrew. The cavalry force that Notre-Dagon had sent to find Martin's false reinforcements then returned to their original camp. On realizing that Notre-Dagon was defeated, and that the Romans held the region entirely, they took a secluded route and rushed to Mojeresis. Notre-Dagon then left most of his cavalry at Mojeresis, and returned to spend winter in Iberia with a small retinue. Welcome to the winter of 556. To connect with us, feel free to find us on social media under @history_Georgia, or on Facebook at The History of Sacagawea, Georgia. Our intro music is Bindi Speria Sopeli by Zadashe. Also, episode 50 is coming up fast, so get your questions in for the AMA. To help this podcast continue, please feel free to subscribe to our Patreon or donate via Ko-fi or PayPal. The links are in the episode description. If you would prefer donating something a bit more tangible, we also have an Amazon wishlist for you to peruse. The best way to help us is via review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcast host, as it goes a long way with getting the word out about the show and helping us reach new people to learn about Georgia. Madlaba da nakvamdis, and thank you for listening to The History of Sakadvelo, Georgia. See you next time.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.